Well, it looks like not too many people are showing up. Probably wasn't clear communication on whether we were actually going to do this Monday night.
Well, we can't blame Scotty for being home late from work. He probably didn't work today.
Probably not. I know Dave Larson didn't mention it, and I talked to him the other evening, but I guess his mind is on other things tonight.
Okay, very good. Is he starting a new term?
Yes, I think his retirement was official a day or so ago, and I believe his new term begins this week.
Okay, so we can say congratulations on his retirement and now get back to work?
Yeah, about like always.
Is he still teaching classes even though he's retired?
Yes, I believe he's teaching two courses this session.
Okay. Yeah, I'm replacing a faculty member who's retiring, but by retiring, he still has the office right next to me and he's still teaching a course this semester.
That seems to be pretty standard procedure these days. Everyone I know, in fact, is in more or less that situation. If they're faculty and all the staff types are doing the same thing in just an equivalent way.
Yeah, it seems to work out pretty well for the faculty members because they like, you know, staying involved somewhat, but not having quite as heavy of a workload.
Yeah, it's nice to have access to the world you're used to. Don't want it to be too abrupt, but I think everybody's kind of glad to have a little breather, though.
Absolutely.
Nathaniel, thank you very much for getting all the comments on the receiver document. And I think I addressed all of them in an update to the receiver requirements document. We did have one open question, and I don't think we had the right folks on the call last week to address it, but it was real helpful to get all the feedback and be able to go in and modify the document. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And we'll be glad to continue doing that as we need to.
Okay, that one, I think that was the more difficult of them in terms of having, you know, numbers and analog requirements and things. There may be other requirements that arise on the local host and the software and things that'll get fairly detailed, but those will probably come up in the course of the project.
That makes sense. So I think the one question that you still had open was regard to switching in and out the noise source, and you were saying that the pin diode would probably be too expensive and might cause interference to, say, AM broadcast reception.
Yeah. I think the pin won't be too expensive, but I'm worried it's going to have third order intermod problems if strong AM broadcast signals, and in fact, if anything below about 2 megahertz gets into the pin diode switch, the pins stop being pins and turn into rectifier kind of things, that they're going to generate a lot of intermod. And so for pins, I think you're going to have to filter out with a high pass filter. If there's some other fast switching technology that doesn't have that drawback, I don't know what it is, but but I likely fear it will be expensive.
Okay, I'm really... I don't know what would be the best choice there, so I kind of have to trust you on that. I don't know, though, if, like you said, if you could put a filter on that, if that would work. I don't know if some of those architectures are worth thinking about. Because from talking to Phil, it seemed like having this high switching capability in there really does substantially increase the scientific capabilities of the instrument.
Okay, I understand. There was a couple comments about keeping the noise diode turned on 100% of the time, and I think there are some thermal diodes that's probably pretty important. On a Zener diode, I don't know there will be a time constant to the Zener diode, but I think that'll be an electrical time constant and a power dissipation constant. I don't know how sensitive the noise is on the Zener to its temperature. So there may or may not be a strong time constant there. So we may have to wait until Phil can get back and go through it. The key point is if we need to switch it quickly, I think we're going to have to either find an expert or else, you know, we run the risk of not being able to do measurements below about 2 megahertz.
Was it established just how fast switching was desirable, or was that still an open question?
My reading of the document was it was kind of in the 1 millisecond time frame where you'd have the noise turned on for a millisecond, turned off for a millisecond, et cetera. I don't know if that was on last week's TeamSpeak call or where I heard that, but that was my recollection.
Yeah, I think we put some rough numbers into the document that I annotated. I could go back and look at that.
I'll bring it up here real quick. I've got it on the desktop somewhere.
Okay, that sounds good.
The ideal solution would be if somebody knew a solid state switching requirement that didn't have third order intermod problems and didn't have frequency response issues and was cost effective, of course, that'd be the best solution.
Maybe we can send that back over to Phil, because even if he doesn't know, he might know someone at Haystack that has that kind of knowledge.
Yeah, that would be the key. That's I think that would, in my view, be the best answer to the question.
Okay. Would you mind just emailing Phil again that question and CCing me on it? And if we don't get an answer from Phil, I'll ping him later this week. I already have a telecon set up with him for later this week anyway.
Okay. I will do that indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. The comment said that the switch should operate typically between 10 to 1,000 hertz. And so so that would be 1 millisecond to 100 milliseconds. You know, we can do the you know, 15, 20 millisecond kind of switching with relays without difficulty. The 1 millisecond switching with relays, I think, would be problematic. I'll go ahead and throw that together and copy your comment in the email.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Nathaniel, I noticed I am using what's called Adobe Reader 11. And when I went in to run the update, it said, this version of Adobe Reader is no longer supported. And I'm wondering if there's maybe a newer version out that you put the comments in.
I was using Adobe DC Pro, I believe.
Okay, no problem. I'll go hunt around and see if my reader is out of date. I had a little difficulty extracting the comments, and I was assuming because I had a badly out of date version.
Yeah, I know those. It was really funny when it worked out really nicely when I was having the telecon to use the commenting feature to put the comments in. But yeah, I noticed that trying to read them, if you don't have the right software, if you're just trying to pull them out, that was very difficult.
Yeah, I tried dumping it as a binary and then going in with Hexedit, but it wasn't very clean. And so I just found cutting and pasting the screenshots was the easiest. I think Phil had a similar issue, if I read his response correctly. But we got them all out, and we're able to roll them all into the document. So super helpful and really good. And I know it's a lot of work to go through something like that. I guess that's the good side of having so many documents. No one document is very big.
Absolutely, I agree.
Nathaniel, what are your plans for DCC?
So my plans are definitely to be there, and I am supposed to be. So Scotty already came up with a draft program, and I'm supposed to start off Saturday morning by giving a 15-minute brief talk about like the status of the overall project. And then I think you're giving a talk, someone else is giving a talk. And then after that, I have a time slot to give like a science case study. And then Phil is going to be giving a science case study after that.
Okay, that sounds like it should be an interesting morning. And I think it's real good to introduce it with a 15-minute start. I think that'll get the audience understanding the issues. That sounds very nice.
Did you see the draft, Graham?
No, I did not.
Yeah, let me bring that up so I can tell you exactly what it is. And by the way, I've been having some trouble with getting onto the Tangerine SDR email list because I tried switching from my Gmail address to my Scranton address, and I'm having some issues with that. So I'm still trying to work that out with Scotty and with the University of Scranton.
Okay. Yes. I don't know if Dave Larson is involved in the email part or if that's all Scotty.
Scotty's been the one who's been trying to address my issues so far. It's been really weird because he said that my Scranton address is in the system, but I can't. And if I send something from the Scranton address, it does go out, but I don't get anything back to that email address. And I've looked in my junk folder and I've looked in my clutter folder and a number of other things, and I don't see anything. So it just seems to be going in a black hole somewhere. And so I'm thinking the next thing I need to do is talk to our tech support here and see if it's getting filtered out at a higher level.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know how the universities do it. At previous employers, they had a lot of filtering.
I think it varies from university to university. So I'll have to check with what they do here.
Okay. Yep. Could do something weird.
I posted a link to the preliminary schedule for DCC.
User in your channel timed out. User entered your channel.
Okay, I got that. Very good. Thank you very much for the schedule, Dave.
Just to get it on the record, on the recording, I just wanted to say that the participants tonight are just myself, Dave, WKD0EAG, Nathaniel, W2NAF, and Tom, N2EG. So if anybody listens to the recording, they'll know who was talking to who.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Dave. Yeah, we're a little disconnected here with our MC not being available tonight. Thank you for filling in.
Not very good at it.
Well, you've done plenty good.
Hello, are you there?
Yeah, you're back.
Yeah, sorry, I got disconnected somehow, but I have a wired connection now, so hopefully it's better.
Okay, very good. Do you have a good internet service in your new location?
I do. I'm up in the attic, and the Wi-Fi router is down like two floors below, and I just got a wire run from down there to up here, so I do have good internet now.
Okay, very good. That when I first moved into this house, I had to do archaeology in order to figure out where the Ethernet cables could go.
Yeah, I was really lucky with this rental because they actually had the rooms pre-wired. So I updated the switch in the basement because they had like a 100 megabit switch. So I just put a gigabit switch in the basement, and then they had all the wires already in for me. So that was really nice.
Yeah, the gigabit Ethernet is nice. It's very plug and play, and you can tandem switches. You can do all kinds of neat things, and it's kind of automatic in sorting them all out.
Yeah, it's really great. So I don't know, did I miss something you said while I had my connection problem?
Oh, I don't know. Dave found a copy of the preliminary schedule, and he posted the link to it on the text part of TeamSpeak.
Oh, okay, great. Yeah, because I just found the preliminary schedule too, and I wonder if it matches what you posted.
I refreshed it just a few minutes ago, but I can never be sure what's coming from cache.
Yeah, oh no, that looks like that's good. That's the one that's actually on the Tapper website, so it's probably more up to date than the one that I have. So you can see on Saturday morning, all of Saturday morning is a Tangerine SDR and HamSci. And even the talk after lunch is a HamSci type of talk given by one of the University of Scranton students that I'm bringing.
Okay, that sounds pretty interesting. So it looks like we're going to have a real full Saturday, that early Saturday morning. That's really good. It should be good for the attendees to have the introduction onto what's going on. You know, some examples of real hardware, some examples of measurements, and then an update on you know, the observations. That sounds like a nice, kind of like a nice session.
Yeah, I think that will work out really well.
I was looking at the hotel map. It looked just like the hotel map from last year. I think you could take any hotel conference room map and change the room names, and you wouldn't have to redraw the map.
It makes it really easy. So the other thing that I'm working on is I have an invited paper for something called the IRSI Bulletin, and this actually is an IEEE publication. And they want me to write about the personal space weather station. So I'm working on a manuscript that's going to be based off of the proposal that you've seen already, and off of the Tangerine SDR documents. And my goal is to have a draft of that manuscript by the time we get to the DCC, so that we can pass it around to appropriate people and get comments, and then get it out the door shortly thereafter.
Okay, that would be very efficient. Scotty and I and John will be there. So you'll have a good crew of people to at least give it the once over.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it will also be good because I think by, you know, writing up this document this way, it'll kind of help to, once again, just refocus what we're doing and make sure we're all on the same page and all of that sort of stuff.
Okay, very good. I was just looking at the Sunday seminar on satnogs. That is also a good seminar because is there a lot of satnogs that kind of is similar to what we plan to do in terms of centralized data capture?
Yes, that's true. Bill Engelke is planning on using satnogs basically as a model or a starting point for what he's planning on doing. So yeah, I'm looking forward to the Sunday seminar there.
Okay, very good. That's interesting. I think this is going to be a really nice session put all together here. I'm trying to read the schedule while talking. Is probably not a good thing to do.
The other one to look out for is the Friday at 4 p.m. Christina Collins. It says a line in the path, which I think is kind of hard to understand, but I think she's probably going to be talking about the Case Western portion of the DAISY project.
Ah, okay, okay, yeah. She was at HAMSI, wasn't she?
Yes, she was. And so I think what's going to happen is I think David Kasdan is going to become the PI, the Case Western PI for the DAISY project, and Christina is going to be a funded grad student for 3 years on the project.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Is this project the one that's the simpler receiver for receiving WWV and CHU, those things?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. That should be an interesting presentation as well.
Yeah. And I'm trying to get the Case Western people to start checking into this telecon as well, so that, you know, we all are kind of on the same page knowing, you know, what each part of the project is doing.
Okay, are they going to be able to use the host computer and the software that Bill's working on?
That is the goal. The goal is to have the software be interoperable between all the different systems, the low-cost system and the high-cost system. But of course, with a high-cost system, you might have more expensive hardware, but the software should be compatible between both systems.
Okay. Very good. Do you know if Bill is going to be at DCC?
I don't know for sure, but I'm pretty sure he is because I've mentioned him a couple times that I would see him there, and I don't remember him saying that he wasn't going to be there.
Okay, very good. Well, that should be, it'd be fun to talk. I don't know if you were on last week. I mentioned to Scotty that I had recorded a 15-minute section of 20 meters at 96 kilosamples per second, and for a GNU radio seminar that I'm given a couple of weeks after DCC, and I had to send that file to the guy putting together the USB sticks, it turned out that it compressed with zip surprisingly well.
Well, that's really good to hear.
Yeah, it was not quite, but almost 3-to-1 compression with a 7-zip. And so I think we probably ought to discuss that with Bill. If we can reduce our upload times by 3-to-1, a lot, that really helps solve a lot of issues.
That would be excellent.
I didn't think it was going to do that. I assumed the samples would be totally random and the compressor wouldn't find much, but the file uses 32-bit floating point I and 32-bit floating point Q, and I'm guessing there must be enough structure in how you define a floating point number and the mantissa and the exponents and stuff that the compression can remove all that overhead.
Yeah, that's excellent. That's very good to hear.
I haven't tried it on an HDF5. It's only been on a raw GNU radio, so it's just a stream of bytes that Python would put out. But I'm hopeful that you'd get a similar result with HDF5. It probably wouldn't be a bad thing for Bill to try if he has a little bit of time.
Yeah, I would think it would probably give you a similar result, because my understanding of HDF5 is it's primarily a way of just structuring the data and adding metadata to data files. So the underlying data is essentially going to be the same. So if you zipped it, you know, that should be fine. I think also there's actually ways of zipping the data within the HDF5 file. So I think you can actually store compressed data in there. But in one way or the other, I think you should be able to achieve a similar result.
Okay. Yeah, Bill had done some experiments that where he tried to compress on the fly while saving, and he was running into substantial throughput problems. And so it may be that it's easier to save the raw data uncompressed and then just compress it for transmission to the server.
Right, that makes sense.
So that'd be fun. That'd be a good thing if it worked out.
Yeah, I think so. The other thing that I was talking with Bill and the other scientists about is I think very soon we want to define a basic running mode or common mode for, you know, what we want the receiver to listen to when you just turn it on, if we don't have it doing anything else special. So just come up with a common mode and get that ready, you know, to start building that out and start testing it once we have some hardware.
Okay. Would you want that as something that's like a script, you know, a startup script? So when you start the application, it goes out and reads the script, and the script says, set up all of these defaults.
Yeah, I think you could think of it like that, some sort of a default mode.
Yeah, the other way, of course, is you could embed that into some lower level portion of code, but then it would be difficult to change.
Yeah, no, I don't think we need to have it embedded. We need to just have it as a higher level thing.
Okay, that sounds good. Yeah, I would think a startup script would be easy to do. And it's certainly nice to know if the power goes out and the host restarts that you know where it's going to come back.
Yeah, and the sort of thing I'm thinking of is like, if you just turn this on and you don't have any other information, you basically want the receiver doing something. And so we'd probably have it in some sort of mode where it's listening either to WWV or to ionosondes and trying to get oblique ionospheric soundings, learn some things about traveling ionospheric disturbances and send that back to the server system. And that would be our common mode of operation. And then if we had some sort of campaign or special experiment, then we could define a new mode and push that out or make it available as an app or something like that.
Okay. Yeah, I could see where we could have, you know, scenarios, you know, or campaigns, whatever, you know, where, you know, we call them number one, number two, number three, number four, a bunch of standard ones. And you could tell a local host, you know, just, you know, go load up profile number three and run it.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the things I'm kind of modeling this on in the back of my mind is the way the SuperDarn radar systems operate. They come out with a monthly schedule. They have they have three types of time modes. Let's just call it, we'll reduce it to two kind of time modes for now. They'll have a special time, and they will have common mode time. And during the common mode time, all of the radars in the network around the world, they have to be running a compatible mode where they're trying to look for large-scale ionospheric velocities. When you run the special mode times, the individual PIs of the different radars, they can design their own radar operating mode to look for special things that they might be looking for in particular. And this way, it kind of balances having the system work as a large-scale network versus having it be able to do more individualized sort of things.
Okay. So if you were able to generate a table or a script that outlines and describes the measurement profile, you could put that into a cron table and, say, at 3 a.m. every day, pull up profile number 2, and then, from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., pull up profile 1 or something like that.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay, so it sounds like the what would be useful is to have a graphical way to construct the measurement profile, such that the tool can turn that into the script command that the host would need to run to get those measurements.
Yes, right. But I think that's absolutely true. But I think the first thing to do is define this common mode that we want it. Just that we want the whole system running all the time as like its default mode or fallback mode or just what it normally operates.
Okay. Yeah. So you could have a mode 0 that's always running unless it's preempted by some other mode.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. We'll let Bill and those guys are the Linux experts. I'm sure he could probably whip that out in 5 minutes.
Yeah, I think that would be a Bill side of the Bill question sort of thing.
Okay, very good. Well, I hope I get the chance to see him. It'll be good to meet up in person. I think I've met him once before, but a couple of years ago, we didn't have a chance to chat because we were working on different projects. But if we get everybody there, we ought to come preloaded with our list of questions since we're going to have all the experts in one place.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea because I know... Yeah, I'm pretty sure Bill's coming. I know I'll be there. Phil Erickson's going to be there. Gareth Perry is going to be there. Christina Collins from Case Western. So, and of course, all the Tapper people. So we'll pretty much have all of the major people who are involved in the same room together.
Okay. Well, we ought to collect up all the questions. I'll go back. I've been keeping all of the weekly meeting minutes. And so before DCC, I'll comb those and see if I have a useful list in there.
Okay, that'd be really great. Thank you, Tom.
Well, Dave, have you had the chance to run any magnetometer tests yet?
Well, I was afraid you'd ask me that. Yes, I have. I was just getting, I was working on code, trying to make a nice, clean little library for interacting with the device. But I've had a lot more than I expected of family responsibilities here. We have a portion of our family who's here from Europe for an extended stay, and that's put holes in my time. That have been hard to get, but I expect I'll have that all buttoned up hopefully this week.
Okay, very good. Are you going to be able to get to DCC this year?
Yes, I bought tickets for myself and for Dave Larson last night, I think.
Oh, great, great. So the two Daves will be there. That's good news.
Yeah, it should be pretty much everybody here, as far as I know.
Okay. Well, I look forward. I hope you get the time. I know things are drawing short with DCC, so it'd be interesting to see what you have at DCC, and if you don't get there, well, there's still plenty of time on the project.
Well, I'm quite sure I'll get it done. I really haven't tested the, you know, the extender part of it is really what I haven't fooled with, but I'll get that squared away.
Okay, very good. Do you have 100-foot Ethernet cable or 100-foot cable of some type to try on the extender?
I think I certainly have some 50-foot store-bought Cat 5, you know, cables. Haven't looked closely to see if they go 100. If not, I may well get one. I've actually had a lot of network problems here in my house too, because while I was out west, we have had some pretty serious thunderstorms come through and took out, you know, one port on a switch here and one port on one of my DSL lines, and so I've been having trouble getting all that back together too. But I'm having to rethink my house wiring, so I'll probably make sure I have a 100-foot one.
Okay, very good. Yeah, they make these real inexpensive modular couplers that, you know, if you have two 50-footers, you can at least, you know, patch them together for the few minutes it takes to run the test.
Well, I've been doing this for so long, I always seem to need one before long, so there's no problem in getting whatever's required. I don't have any shielded, you know, Cat 5-6 shielded cable. Never really worked with it, but I have the standard ones that are from the office supply stores and such.
Okay, well, that's good information. The standard speed on the SPI is 100 kilobits per second, and my back of the envelope calculation said you should be able to go 100 feet at standard speed.
Yeah, on I squared C. Yeah. Uh-huh. I think that it ought to be, but there may be a nuance here or there somewhere. I do want to check it and test it to be sure.
Yeah, that would be great. The power over Ethernet stuff, I had a lot of issues with it on towers. We put for ham stuff, we put Wi-Fi access points up on top of towers that were PoE powered, and usually they're out in a remote location up in the mountains, and generally there was a once a year trip to replace the device, because invariably we'd find the PoE tap on the receive side burned out.
Yeah, that's pretty much my experience too. But there are a lot of little PoE devices available right now, that are pretty well made. So I'm going to see. I'll try to look at that as well.
Yeah, I'm hopeful we won't have quite so much an issue with the magnetometer. It won't necessarily be mounted high, and we're only planning to run 5 volts down the cable. So, you know, fingers crossed, hopefully it's not too severe of an application.
I had one that the first one I was working with, I was a little worried that it wasn't working correctly one day, and so I got a couple of extras. So I'm well supplied, but everything seems to be working that I have on hand, so should know soon.
Okay, very good. I'll look forward to you know, what you have time to get, and I'm sure everybody at DCC will be interested in seeing the results. Well, Nathaniel, do you have anything more?
I think that's about it for now. I think we had a really good discussion. I think send Phil that email. I'm going to be working on that paper. One thing I'm going to be trying to do now that I'm bringing the grant over to Scranton, I think I'm going to try to hire a postdoc to be working on the algorithms for the radio science part of these things. So I think I can afford a 2-year postdoc. So I think that's kind of the big news over here, and I think that would really help the project.
Okay, that sounds interesting. That'll probably happen a little later in the project, but it'd be neat to see what kind of algorithms that are being worked on.
Yeah, I think the postdoc would probably start this coming June. And the idea is, when do you think we might see the first iteration of the hardware for this project? Would it be about that same time?
I don't know. I will have to say that's a Scotty question. I think Scotty is the guy doing the board layout.
Yeah, so I'll have to talk with him. But basically, we're going to have someone who knows something about, you know, about the ionosphere and about what we're actually looking for scientifically, I think, to actually write some of this code and develop those algorithms. And that's what I'd want the postdoc to do.
Okay, very good. Yeah, and I'm sure that's a person who's going to need to consult a little bit on the characteristics of the hardware, because they probably cause some unusual influences on the observations.
Yeah, so I'll have to, yes, so there's going to be some iteration on this. I'll have to talk to Scotty about this some more, but I think the idea is that we have at least two runs of the hardware. You know, the initial run, and then there'd be one other run that we could do iterations on. So if we find that something doesn't work, there's enough money in the budget to do, make some minor adjustments and then do one more run and then go from there.
Okay. Yeah. So these typically there'll be a couple of prototypes. So you're talking about runs after the prototypes have been debugged?
No, I'm talking, these would be the prototypes.
Okay. Well, yeah, my experience has been it'll take at least two prototypes, but typically you'll only build one or two of the prototypes. And if you have the kind of luck I have on prototypes, the first one you plug in is a total dud, and the second one at least comes up and does something.
Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah, it's always something silly, usually involving a component library where you get 5 volts and ground backwards or something.
That makes sense.
Okay, I'll go ahead and get out the notes for tonight and start trying to consolidate a discussion list for DCC.
Okay, that sounds great, Tom. I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Very good. Well, 73 is Nathaniel, and Dave to you as well, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you so much, Tom. 73 to you also.
And 73 to you both. Yeah, we'll talk again next week, perhaps. Take care.